Yes. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I get the sense that this is more of a quantum electric effect than a wave effect. And so I think you're dealing here somewhat more with photons, you know, light as characteristic of photons as opposed to light as a wave. So I think it has more to do with electron of energy levels and band gaps and such than it does a pure wave analogy.
Okay, maybe we're onto something here. Maybe the exciting signal at 1,070 nanometers is taking the individual molecules, I'm going to say, of the crystal, and those electrons in those molecules are stepping to higher energy levels and dropping back down, and that's the part of the nonlinear process. Is that possibly what's going on? The dopant materials are being charged by the exciting waveform and dropping back in nonlinear manner. AC2GS, K2RIW.
AC2GS, yes. Usually when I read about these things, they talk about it in quantum mechanical terms as opposed to wave terms. So I think that's the best way to kind of attack the situation, that by doping it, you change the band pass qualities, which is a very common thing. People do that all the time with LEDs to change the frequency of their emission, changing the band pass, the energy levels that are generated and such. So I think it's more a phenomenon of that on a quantum level than it is just a standard nonlinear wave equation.
Sure, John. Go right ahead, Eric.
Two things. While you guys were talking about that, there was something that was stuck in the back of my mind was, I remember about 15 or 20 years ago, I did a little quick search on the web here and found it. It was double the frequency of light. It started with infrared, and they developed a crystal, a composite, which is an organic polymer. And what happens is the infrared light excites the material, which then vibrates at a frequency which is double. So according to this, that it was made from amino acids and nitro group, made to vibrate when exposed to infrared light. It's called secondary harmonic generation. Some inorganic crystals also have those frequency doubling characteristics, but are more difficult to grow, blah, blah, blah. I think this is 1990. Anyway, let me get to the second thing. I'm going to trap it. In your discussion, any rather large or high output LED, 1 watt or bigger, is another form of secondary emission. The LED behind it is actually either infrared or ultraviolet, depending on the manufacturer. That, in turn, excites the phosphor that's mounted on the front of the LED, and that's where you get this ability to create many different color temperatures, because you mix the phosphor to emit the single frequency or band of frequencies. That's why you'll find some LEDs, especially in my business, where we've got LEDs now that pretty much full spectrum. We can replace some of the ridiculous lights that we've used over the years to create daylight or artificial daylight and get away from a lot of the problems of having high voltage and that kind of stuff. So LED technology, in terms of being able to produce not only a single line on the spectrum, but multiple lines and having control over it. K2RIW, K2RIW.
My bathroom, I've got a 40 inch long, 40 watt fluorescent bulb, and I keep buying the True Day Glow or whatever, True Day Color type fluorescent bulbs. They're more expensive and they don't last as long, but they do give you a much more natural kind of white light. It doesn't have this bluish hard characteristic of the less expensive fluorescent bulbs. I'm pretty sure there's a mercury vapor inside, giving you an ultraviolet emission. That in turn hits the phosphor, and it gives me this beautiful white light output. Now, what you and I call white light, in order for it to look white to a human eye, I believe it would have to contain a significant amount of red, green, and blue. Therefore, I'm asking the question, if you happen to know, Eric, is there three kinds of phosphor in that fluorescent bulb? Some of the phosphor is emitting red, some of it's emitting green, some of it's emitting blue. And if it's got the right ratio of those light outputs, my eye sees it as white. Is that the way that phosphor takes ultraviolet and makes white out of it? KE2EJ, K2IW.
KE2IW, KE2EJ. You know, phosphor science, the chemistry of phosphor, it's an old science, something that's been happening for a long time. You know, you've got your scope, when you hit it with an electron, you wind up having green things show up. There are different characteristics of different elements which are made into phosphate. And you can, in fact, in terms of what they do with white LEDs, yes, you have to have a certain amount of red, green, and blue. Actually, when we talk about television, green is the major component, and red is the next major component. Blue is the least major component. Actually, it's 11% blue, 15 or 17% red, and the rest is green. And we put those together, and that makes white. By controlling the amount of a particular chemistry that relates to red, green, and blue of this mixture, you wind up having a single compound that excites lines in the various different parts of the spectrum. So it's not like there's a molecule of this over here that's physically placed there and organized. It's just a mixture. So those molecules are all mixed together and coated onto a glass or whatever the bonding material is. K2IW, K2J.
The wavelength frequency or real spectrum of real sunlight is a continuous frequency spectrum, starting off at roughly 400 nanometers and going up to 700 nanometers is the major.
The eyeball isn't.
Yeah, that's. The eyeball looks at red, green, and blue and does three filters and a filter comparison of the crossover region, and the brain interprets that. But real solar output is a continuous spectrum. Is there a phosphor that makes a continuous spectrum? What's your guess on that? If I used a spectrum analyzer on various kinds of phosphor that look white, would I see a line of red, a line of green, and a line of blue on that spectrum analyzer? Or do you think I would see a continuous spectrum? The phosphors that are currently available, what do you believe the spectral output really would look like with the right kind of lab instrumentation, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Well, we're talking in terms of transmission, it's something generating light. You're looking through a spectrogram. Unfortunately, the way we excite things, excuse me, you're going to see very distinct frequent spectral lines when you're looking through the spectrogram. You won't see one solid bar of red, one solid bar of green and blue. You'll find many bars, some being brighter than each other, in the approximate neighborhood of the frequencies of red, green, and blue. The closest thing that you're going to find, even in today's chemistry, that's a continuous spectrum like the sun, is something that's making its light from heat, like a filament. We can actually do quite well with some filaments and produce broadband output. It's still going to be lines that are favored, that are going to be brighter, but you still have this sort of infinite segments of spectrum. And that's because of nature that's doing it. So, there's actually a better reason than that, but I don't think I can explain it. K2IW, K2J.
Eric, in your earlier discussion, you talked about a frequency doubling crystal which resonates at the higher frequency than the one you're pumping it with. And There's a problem there. If you and I had a resonator at, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles, and if I fed 20 megacycles of signal into it, it would give me no response. If I gave it a pure 5 megacycle signal, half its frequency, again, I would get no response. Just a pure resonator at the frequency that you desire, when you feed some other frequency into it, that's not enough. There has to be some amount of 10 megacycles in the nonlinearity that I'm feeding it at 5 megacycles in order to get a response. So a pure resonator doesn't respond at anything except that frequency you feed it at. That's my guess. So there's got to be something more going on here. KE2EJ, KQIW.
All right, KQIW, KE2EJ, we may be talking about two different things here. Take, for example, a helium neon laser, okay? There's a set of mirrors that create that resonance frequency. And when those mirrors are lined up, and because the gas itself is restricted in what lines of energy it's going to produce, because it's a gas that's being excited, when you get those mirrors lined up, that thing is resonant to that particular frequency. Nothing on either side of it comes out. What we're talking about in terms of like phosphorus is we're really saying we have an excitation energy. I don't care what frequency it is that we're feeding into this matrix, but when we excite this matrix, or if we want to talk it mechanical, when we make it vibrate, it all of a sudden emits photons of a different frequency. So I don't know if the laws of physics don't change between what we do at 5 megacycles as opposed to at light frequency, but we also have devices in electronics where, I got to say this right, because first of all, frequency multiplication in our world is done one of two ways, okay, because a pure sine wave, when you look at it, it's spectrally pure. You need something that's not spectrally pure in order to get something, you know, some harmonic out of it and work with that. I'm trying to get the thoughts out the right way here. Here we're talking about taking some form of energy and making something else happen through, say, a mechanical motion through the
repeater. Timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You're doing very well, Roy. I mean, Eric, but we did lose the last 30 seconds due to a timeout. I'm getting the impression that phosphorus operates by being excited and dropping back and emitting their favorite frequencies. I'm guessing Roy has got some comments on all that he's heard about lasers, frequency doubling, phosphors that produce white light, and so on. So tell us anything about all of the above, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
And the other interesting thing that you can throw in there, Roy, is this magic substance, terbium, and laser light amplifier.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, lasers are a fascinating subject, light amplification through stimulated emission of radiation. They're not necessarily resonant, and the mirrors aren't absolute. One end is perfectly mirrored, the other is partially mirrored, because what you are trying to do is you're pumping electrons that possess a certain amount of energy to a higher energy state, and then you're running similar frequency photons back and forth, causing the energized electrons to drop down in phase. So it's a coherent light rather than most light is incoherent. It's out of phase with each other. And so, you know, lasers are fascinating things, and there's even things called resonance doubling of lasers. So you can double lasers through resonance as well. But lasers are fascinating. They go all the way from infrared to high ultraviolet, and they get rather powerful. Some of the stuff that they're trying to do fusion with have enormous lasers directed in one small bit of droplet of tritium doped hydrogen water.
T2IS, query.
I better recognize, but let's Roy finish what he was saying. And Roy, the laser phenomenon, when you've got a continuous output of the laser, that's a little bit mysterious to me. For it to be charged up and then give you one massive pulse when all of them, when the mirrors hit the resonance, and the wave bounces back and forth, and the other stimulated molecules decide to release their energy in a co-phase manner. That gives you this tremendous burst. But most of the laser pointers you and I use are continuous in output. And so therefore, it's a little bit more difficult to explain what's going on. If I was using an extremely fast detector and oscilloscope, am I really seeing a very large number of pulses in what my eye sees as a continuous wave output? AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS, well, that's a fascinating question. I don't recall, they do call these things continuous wave laser beams, so I always assumed that they were truly continuous rather than very fast pulse laser beams. I think the difference is more in the ability to deal with the power output. Some laser beams are so powerful and they dissipate so much waste heat that you simply can't operate them full duty. So I think it's more based upon the technology and the output of a laser, whether it's a pulse laser or a continuous wave laser. And I don't think there's anything inherently disallowed in quantum mechanics that allows for a continuous process of pumping up ions into higher energy space and simply having the light keep on reflecting back and forth with a certain percentage going out the half-mirrored end of the laser.
D2IS, query.
We're going to get to you in a second, Bill. I want to finish this question first. I've seen some of these laser outputs being displayed on a very high technology spectrum analyzer. And many of these so-called continuous laser outputs put out a whole bunch of comb lines very close together. Those comb lines look to me like they're, if the main output is at 500 nanometers, those individual comb lines look to me like they're separated by, I'll pick a number, 20 nanometers. And 20 nanometers, I could convert that into a frequency. And I'm beginning to think that some of these continuous laser outputs are really pulsing at an extremely fast rate. That's what's making those comb lines. That's a guess on my part. AC2GS, K2LIW.
I mean, you might be quite right. I haven't really done a great deal of research into the little nitty-gritty details. When it gets to be very, very, very fast, all kinds of strange things. You know, you increase the resolution. You know, you're going on the pigments of phosphorus. At very low resolution, you probably get some kind of Gaussian, complex Gaussian distribution. But if you narrow the resolution of the spectroscopy, it probably ends up being a whole bunch of separate spikes that are close to each other in some places. So, it's possible. And my guess is there is also the in-between. My surmise is that there are cavity structures that produce these short-duration bursts rapidly and as well as continuous. But maybe I got to hit the books again to see if there's anything that's truly continuous.
In a minute, I'm going to ask a couple of questions on a so-called Q-switched laser generator. But let's first go over to Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, this is AC2IS, and at work...
I've been working on a project that involves, well, mostly planning phase. I'm not sure this project is ever actually going to happen. But if it does, it'll involve a number of erbium-doped amplifiers. So when I heard you guys mention that, I figured, hey, here's my opportunity to learn something about that. An erbium-doped amplifier will amplify light in a wide range of frequencies, right? But we've been talking about how various materials, you know, they'll absorb energy, and, you know, an electron will get into an excited state and then drop down, and it'll want to emit a photon that's, you know, related to the type of material and the amount of distance, I guess, or the difference in energy levels between the excited state and the ground state, which is, you know, generally specific to the molecule or atom we're talking about. So how is it that an erbium-doped amplifier is able to amplify light of such a wide range of frequencies and with no apparent restriction on like how close together these different frequencies are? It can amplify almost any number of frequencies simultaneously. So, how is it that one piece of equipment can emit photons of such different frequencies, AC2IS?
I'm going to pass this one over to Eric at first. In the early days, when you didn't have transistors that operated at 500, 1,000, 2,000 megacycles, the only way we knew of to get amplification at those days was use a parametric diode, a diode that varies capacitance versus voltage, and you set it up with idler circuits and whatever, and circulators, as a parametric amplifier. Is an erbium-doped light amplifier at all like a parametric amplifier? I mean, the nice thing about an erbium-doped amplifier, you didn't have to do the old-fashioned thing of taking the light, detecting it, bringing it down to some lower video frequency, amplifying the video frequency, and then bringing it back up to the light output. It's a very complicated process. To do that one step with an erbium-doped light amplifier, to amplify the light signal directly, that sounds like it's got all kinds of advantages. However, what in the world is going on there that creates the amplification? KE2EJ, give us any words on this, because I'm in the dark. There's a pun there somewhere. Just do RIW. You got it, Eric.
Just do RIW, K2J. It's all a matter of excitation and putting energy where it falls off. I got to pull up the page that gives the perfect way to explain it. But just consider this. It's a tiny little box which has a laser diode. It's actually fed through this material that is doped into the glass, and what it actually does is raise the energy of the light that's passing through it. So it's not a case of where you'd have to actually take the light, put it into a diode, send it back into an analog signal, do something with it. You don't even have to amplify it. All you have to do is excite another laser diode and remodulate the light. But using dope erbium, you don't have to do any of that. Give me a second and I'll give you a really good explanation.
If there's another laser diode emitter inside that erbium-doped amplifier, that sounds like the pump oscillator that's in a parametric amplifier. I'm seeing a possible relationship here. Over to you, Eric, and take your time. K2RIW.
Yeah,
K2RIW.
Yeah, it does actually sound like it. What does Roy know about this? That should be interesting. It's going to take me about another 30 seconds to find the page I'm looking for.
You got it, Roy. Wait for the beep.
AC2GS, gosh, what does Roy know about this? I think we're all alluding to something called tunable lasers. Yag lasers are one of them. The problem, or the good thing about lasers, is they're not absolutely monochromatic. There's a little bit of a wiggle room range, and so you can tune different lasers to a different degree depending upon the technology that's being used to excite the photon. And there's a whole bunch of incredibly esoteric ways that it's done. There are external cavity lasers that use the spaces between the mirror. There's all kinds of mumbo-jumbo terms for some of these things, like periodic distributed Bragg reflectors and vertical cavity surface emitting lasers, all kinds of fun stuff. Ultimately, what it amounts to the most part, is tweaking the device dimensions to favor one end of the small range of tunable frequencies of a given laser technology.
There's something called an Adler loop oscillator, Adler loop, phase-lock loop-like system. If you've got a very low Q oscillator, oscillating at, say, 1 gigahertz, and you give it and you inject into that oscillator a small amount of signal that's 5 megacycles away from the 1 gigahertz where it wants to oscillate. If the Q of the oscillator is low enough, and you inject enough of a signal, and the signal might be 10 or 15 dB weaker than the real oscillator output, but there's 10 or 15 dB weaker signal, that's 5 or 10 megahertz higher, so to speak, the oscillator will jump over to that injected frequency and continue to oscillate at that frequency. Because the because the oscillator output might be running at the 1 watt level, and I'm injecting a signal that is 15 dB weaker than 1 watt output, but the oscillator decides to oscillate at my injected frequency, I could now convince myself that I've got 15 dB of gain out of this thing because I'm injecting a frequency, and what comes out is exactly my frequency, but 15 dB stronger. And now if I'm FM modulating my signal, out comes a beautiful, stronger FM modulated signal. I don't think this thing would work very well with amplitude modulation, but with frequency modulation, an Adler loop oscillator, phase-lock loop-like system, looks to me like it can have some very nice advantages. This might be a different kind of direct amplifier than the erbium-doped light amplifier we're talking about, but maybe Eric has found what he's looking for. KE2EJ, if he's ready. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hear me, Dick?
I heard you say, did you hear me, Dick? It was quiet until you said, do you hear me, Dick?
Okay. Sounds like there's something going on here. A little bit of stuff happening. Anyway, here's a basic principle. Okay. A relatively high-powered beam of light is mixed with the input signal using a wavelength selective coupler. Okay, the input signal and the excitation light must be significantly different wavelengths. The mixed light is guided into a section of fiber with erbium ions included in the core. The high-powered light beam excites the erbium ions to the high-energy state. When the photons belonging to the signal at a different wavelength from the pump light meets the excited erbium the erbium atoms, the erbium atoms give up some of their energy to the signal and return to their lower energy state. They drop. The significant point is that the erbium gives up its energy in the form of additional photons, which are exactly the same phase and direction of the signal being amplified. So the signal is amplified along with the direction of travel only. This is not unusual when an atom lasers. It always gives up energy in the same direction and phase as the incoming light. Thus, all of the additional signal power is guided in the same fiber mode as the incoming signal. There's usually an isolated place at the output to prevent reflection, like a directional coupler, from returning to the attached fiber. Such reflections disrupt the amplifier operation and in extreme cases can cause the amplifier to become a laser. The erbium-doped amplifier is a high-gain amplifier.
Does that kind of explain it?
Yeah, I think it comes close. I'm starting to see it somewhat. You have reason to believe that this erbium-doped light amplifier over a particular amplitude region is linear. Like all amplifiers, I'm sure if you put in a signal that's too strong, it becomes nonlinear. But does it continue to operate all the way down to zero signal amplitude and continue to give the exact same number of decibels of gain? What's your guess on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Interesting you should ask that, because one of the systems that we put in New York, we had the ability to simulate attenuation. And there's a point where you get down to where it just simply stops working, because there's just not enough input. As far as it being nonlinear down there, I really couldn't say, because the gain is pretty consistent, of course, wherever we set it for. That was a while ago. But yeah, one thing that I will say is that there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these things out in the world. You happen to have Fios or the various other types of fiber base. You're using these devices. Actually, I'm looking at a picture of it in terms of how the light is injected and the shape of the fiber and it moves itself. It kind of looks like a circulator. It's RIWK to again. Oh, by the way, what I wanted to say now is that in the real world, you don't amplitude modulate the light per se, whereas that you have the zero light. So there's a lot of different methods of modulating the light. Some of them, a lot of them are actually FM, some of them QAM, a whole series of different ways of doing it. K2RIWK to again.
It was interesting, Eric, that in the erbium-doped amplifier that you worked with, as you put in weaker signals, you made it sound like at a particular amplitude input signal level, it suddenly dropped out of operation, a hard cutoff. It wasn't a signal that got weaker and weaker and got into the noise. It just ceases to operate. That makes it sound a little bit like an Adler loop or phase lock loop, so to speak. That's what it makes it sound like. So there's a particular amplitude region over which the thing works well. And below that region, I think it does not. By the way, I'm getting some intermittent dropouts of my power here, and I'm hearing some very high wind. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KQEJ. I'm over here at Wolf, actually, and I came in. I know the power had gone away for a little while. Of course, we've got a big generator that kicks in, and it actually kicked in. So, not running now, but it happened early this morning. Whatever. All right, I guess that's where I wanted to go. KQRIW, K3J.
It takes a certain length of time for your generator, your standby generator at your broadcast station, to come alive. When you get a power dropout, what gives you flywheel action? What keeps you on the air for, let me pick a number, let's assume it takes 30 seconds to bring your generator up to speed. What keeps you on the air for 30 seconds, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, don't forget, a lot of stations pass over here. So there's a lot of UPSs around, big ones. Actually, back to main place, there's a 125 kVA UPS that keeps the place running for about 2 hours. But my generator kicks in and flips over in about 20 seconds. Actually, less than that. But so the only thing that really gets hit is the transmitter, because that's not on a UPS, but all the support steps on UPS, so they don't go away.
If the transmitter is not on the UPS, does that mean your carrier output to your tower disappears for that 20 seconds that it takes to bring the generator up to speed? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it goes bye-bye. It don't like matter having no electricity. It don't do nothing.
So you go off the air for 20 seconds and then come back on is what I think you're saying.
No, there ain't no other way to do it. I need about a 90 kilowatt UPS. And there's really no point.
Out of curiosity, within a reasonable number of dollars, what's the highest number of kilowatts of output of UPS you can buy? And in theory, you only need it for 30 seconds, so could I buy a 90 kilowatt output UPS that's only good for 30 seconds? Is that possible? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's easy. That's not a problem. Oh, I hear the power company. I have a mechanical regulator that runs up and down as the power company runs up and down. It makes a bit of a racket as it's tracking what's going on the line. Yeah, no, that's easy. You can get to half a megawatt UPS. It takes up a lot of room because it's got a lot of batteries, but it usually will produce full load for over an hour.
WHYY.
Joe recognized, I've got a whole lot of 85-foot high oak trees on my property, and there's always a number of dead branches on those oak trees. In a high wind like this, some of those dead branches break off. So in the last 10 minutes, twice, a limb of a tree broke off and hit the roof of my house and gave me a large thump, and I'm hearing some high winds. WHYY, KTRIW, go ahead, Joe.
Here for over an hour.
Speaking about UPSs, I was out to visit the NOAA weather installation out in the east side of the property at Brookhaven Lab in Upton. I was out there like years and years ago, and the guy was telling me about the different things that handle powers, and I said, oh, what are you doing when you have power for you? He said, well, they have a room full of a bank of batteries that runs a UPS system that will keep that whole installation running for about 2 or 3 minutes until the generating system comes up to, catch up to replace the commercial power. How's that for UPS? And I don't know what they're running for power, but they're running a radar system out there for NOAA weather radar. That's got to be drawing some serious power, wouldn't you think, Dick?
WS2N. Yeah, I think that's a NEXRAD radar running at 8 gigahertz, or 2.8 gigahertz. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I've been in a number of buildings where we'll have some work in a lot of rooms, and we'll go into an existing room, and they'd have these banks of Exide batteries. For some reason, Exide was the popular brand. Exide batteries, and each one, I think, was like 2.5 volts, and there were racks and racks and racks, and they were all hooked up in combinations of series and parallel. I remember being in there. We would be installing fire sprinkler systems, and then we'd install them, and then right after we installed them, we'd have to take them out and plug them just for that room. They didn't want any kind of water ever going into that room. But quite a few of those rooms I was in. By the way, we're up to 16,828 out on Long Island now, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric. Wait for the beep. Don't time out the machine.
K2RW, K2J. Well, speaking of UPSs, in a different frame, if you happen to go by the Home Depot at where Farmingdale Airport is, down on 110 there, and you drive around towards the back of the building, you'll see these huge boxes that say Bloom on them. There's a Bloom box. Those take the natural gas, and inside those boxes they have fuel cells, and that series of boxes creates more than enough power to run the Home Depot without being connected to the outside world. The only bad thing about it is because you're using methane, you're producing carbon dioxide and dumping it out into the air. K2RW, K2J.
I seem to remember one or two of the Google operations are also running some kind of a fuel cell-like operation, similar to what you're describing.
This Home, same company.
Okay. The Home Depot you're describing, that's near Republic Airport, is that on Route 110 or is it off Route 110, Eric? Go ahead.
When you get down to the end of, I guess it's Front Street, and you see the big cinema there, you see the huge shopping center as you're heading south, and then all of a sudden you come to the runway of Farmingdale Airport. And if you look to your left, you'll see there's a huge Home Depot there.
ACQIS, query.
You got it, Bill.
I was just wondering if these boom boxes are things that people are still actively acquiring. I seem to recall there being a big news splash about the company Bloom, and then a lot of people claiming that it was sort of overhyped technology, and then I didn't really hear much about it after that, so I'm wondering, is this still something that people think highly of? AC2IS.
And when you answer that one, Eric, had you heard a funny buzz output of the repeater twice in the last couple of minutes? KE2EJ, KQIW.
I didn't hear the question, Dick.
The repeater made a funny buzz output for 1 second twice in the last couple of minutes.
To be quite honest, I didn't notice. But don't forget, we have multiple inputs going on here, so it can't be any, you know, it can be any one number of sources. So, as far as I know, Bloom is a very productive business. No, it's created by a guy who came out of NASA, and he uses his proprietary method of turning sand into the elements that he needs.
The fuel cells that they used on the Apollo spacecraft, there was something about them where if you ever turned them off, you couldn't turn them back on again.
And the zircon-based fuel cell.
Repeat that one, and I'm about to ask you what's different about that from the Bloom device. But what was going on with the Apollo fuel cells that you couldn't turn them off and turn them back on again? KE2EJ, KQIW.
KQIW, KQJ. This is before the days of PEM membrane. I can't remember what the acronym stands for. But that's where the exchange barrier is between hydrogen and the oxygen. Use an alkaline-based material, and because the fuel cell is an endothermic type of reaction that makes its own heat, when you turn it off, the whole mess in there solidifies from the colder space. It's mounted in the outer parts of the Apollo service module, from what I remember.
Okay, I heard a very weak signal. Take your time, give us your call letters and your name and your information. Go right ahead, sir. It sounded like KDG, KQRIW. My name is Dick.
Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Delta Golf. My name is Paul. In my area, there is a power outage right now, and I picked up this repeater. Now, the courtesy tone is different, which this is normally the WTL repeater. I'm in Nassau County. So I don't know how far I'm getting since there's basically no interference right now.
Okay. We're hearing you quite well, Paul. A little bit noisy. I think you're saying you don't normally operate here because of other local repeaters. Are you running on battery power right now, Paul? KD2 Kilo Delta Golf, KQLAW.
I don't have the battery hooked up to it. I was trying to use HF on battery and didn't have that much luck, mostly because the bands aren't too active right now. Where is the repeater that I'm talking on right now? Over.
There's really two repeaters and they're linked together. The main was in Glen Oaks, which is right at the Nassau-Suffolk County border on Long Island. And the other repeater that it's linked to on a slightly different frequency. This frequency is 146.85 output. The other one is 147.375 output, and that one's in Selden, Long Island. So which one are you closest to? And are you feeding a signal into the 146.85, or are you feeding a signal into the 147.375? KD2, KDG, K2LIW.
Actually, he means the Nassau Queens border, and yes, he's going through 85, you can tell from the grid if you don't.
This is W2ZL then, since I recognize those two locations, but I go to a different repeater because the turning component is.
Right now you're hearing a net 32 tone, which is different from the normal one.
Is there also a little bit of confusion, Eric, by the fact that this repeater has a 4Z as a PL input, but the output is a slightly different PL, like 141? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, the reason for that is the intermod. It's a combination of five different transmitters, and two of them are off-site, so we don't have any control over it.
To your knowledge, Eric, are there a significant number of repeaters which use an output PL frequency different than the input? And I see a lot of advantage in doing that. Over to you, Eric.
Now let's put it this way. I'm lazy. Okay, I could have come up with a different solution, but this was quick and dirty. It works fine. Sorry for the folks that have Japanese radios that can't split their PL, but that's the way it is.
On those Japanese radios, is there a way you can program it where it gives a transmitting PL but does not require a receiver PL? Can you ask it to operate that way, Eric? Go ahead.
Unfortunately, most Japanese radios, no. But interestingly enough, most Chinese radios, yes.
That's the good news about the Chinese radios. But if you want to program a Chinese radio from the front panel, that's a significant learning curve for most of us. It's a very unusual method of programming. Over to you, Eric.
Now, so far with every Chinese radio I've seen, you can program it by using a programming cable in your computer, which is one heck of a lot easier, especially if you've got a lot of things to program.
But if you're in the field without that cable or without a local laptop, and you're forced to program it from the front panel, it's a little bit hokey.
Well, it's doable. And if you can read Chinglish, sorry, shouldn't use that word, the manuals take a little bit of deciphering, but that's one way. But you can also spend a couple of bucks and buy. There's a number of people who get cheat sheets out of it. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, there was a fellow that offered to us free of charge a manual which is easier to read. And I wish I had written his call letters. I've got a copy of that manual in my hand right now. But I apparently didn't write his call letters into it. Or at least not that I can find immediately. Nope, not in this copy. Oh well. Okay. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above? Oh yeah, I've got a couple of comments and questions I've got on Q-switch. Every laser usually has a pair of mirrors, one of which is partially filtered. And those two mirrors are some integer number of wavelengths apart at the operating frequency. A Q-switched laser, I am guessing you're doing something that electronically changes that distance to knock it out of resonance until you want the pulse. And then you knock it back into resonance and you get the pulse. Is that essentially the operation of a Q-switched laser, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
I don't think I can answer that adequately. There's a number of different methods that I'm aware of that are more mechanical in nature. I don't want to answer that because I'm not sure I'm going to be able to respond to it quickly. I got to look it up.
So if I, with a solenoid magnet, if I physically moved the mirror to get it into the integer resonant frequency, that would be one way of Q-switching a radar, a laser pulsar. Is that true?
Yeah, you could, but that's kind of problematic because you got to get alignment back exactly precisely to the fraction of a millimeter, almost to the extent of doing it, you know, nanometers or less. Most of the methods that people use in terms of high power lasers being used for communication is they use the equivalent of a specific acoustic wave filter where you only actually have to make it move a fraction of an inch, and the output port actually has a little hole where if you move it that fraction of an inch, it doesn't cover the hole, and when you let it go, it goes through the hole, that kind of idea. Now, I used to work for that laser scanner company. You get the concept of how they move it around.
If I used a piezoelectric device to do the moving, I think I could get some very precise movement.
Yeah, well, that's the way it is. You're basically changing the wave surface of the crystal. Very accurate, and you can do a lot of stuff with it. Gotta say something now. All right, I lost it. Yeah, it's not coming. Sorry.
Okay, interrupt us when you think of it, Eric. I'm about to go over to Paul for the space report, but before we do, let's see if there's any closing comments on the science physics section. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Ray.
AC2GS. Yeah, I think I have an interesting, although maybe to chemists alone. You're talking about the bloom boxes. And the bloom box is a fuel cell that is basically, if you recall last week we were talking about the saboteur device and the saboteur effect. It's basically the saboteur effect in reverse. It's not endothermic, by the way, it's exothermic. But it's methane gas plus oxygen goes to carbon dioxide, water, electricity, and heat.
Sorry about that. The generator, Tony.
That sounds exothermic. And Roy, to your knowledge, can I go out and buy one of these bloom boxes for my home if I'm willing to spend that number of shekels?
I don't know if it's readily available. It sounds like one of those things that's a work in progress. A lot of bits and pieces about the information that aren't readily available. I mean, they're giving them to big companies to advertise their existence, but I don't think they've rolled them out to us poor guys.
From what I remember, they're a few large users, and they're also providing it to some power companies and stuff like that. So they're in production, but I don't think they're making a home unit yet.
So I think you're saying these bloom boxes that are bought are used in commercial installations of megawatt or power regions that we're talking about here, Eric?
No, I don't know about megawatts, but they do have large installations. But I'm aware of that they're used for auxiliary power in power generating stations. It provides juice for field magnets and stuff like that.
The company called Spectra Thin Films runs machines that do vapor deposition onto precision mirrors and precision lenses, vapor deposition for quarter wave matching of the optical surfaces. And in some cases, the machine runs for, let me pick a number, 7 solid days. And the machine itself consumes numbers like a quarter of a million watts. And the owner of that company has looked into the ability to have standby power. And he's come to the conclusion that it would be so expensive and so voluminous to have a quarter of a megawatt of standby power capability. He's better off to run the machine for the week and pray that Loco doesn't have an interruption during that week. If so, that particular protection run is just to wipe out and you start all over again. That's a problem. Can you imagine trying to create standby power for a quarter of a megawatt, quarter or half a megawatt, something in that order, Eric, KE2EJ? That's That's a problem that's in your category, KE2EJ,
K2REW. K2REW, KE2EJ. Not a problem. I've got a quarter of a megawatt system right outside. You only need 1,700 gallons of, diesel fuel to make it run for about 9 days.
Are you saying you've got enough diesel fuel on property to run for some significant number of days without running out of fuel, Eric? In which case, I'm about to say, man, that 140,000 BTUs per gallon of petroleum, that is a beautiful energy storage. I don't think any battery comes close to that.
No battery comes close to that. We have the battery just to cover the period that it takes for the bloody thing to get started. It starts up really fast. And by the way, yeah, there's a 1,800-gallon tank that the whole thing sits on top of.
Lately, I've been discovering, and I maybe mailed you a copy of the article, there's a fair number of informed people who are positive that a very large percentage of the petroleum is created by the Earth abiotically. It was not the death of dinosaurs and plants, that the Earth itself, at a very deep, high-pressure, high-temperature area, created the petroleum, and the proof of that is that some of the oil that we're pumping right now is coming from numbers like 6,000 feet down, and there are no fossils below 2,000 feet. KE2EJ, K2REW.
No, I'm not going there for now. We can do that some other time. Anyway, I'm trying to get out of here. I'll be back on the video in the car. K2REW, K2EJ.
Very fine, Eric. WS2M, what is NASA doing? And hopefully you've got power, Paul. WS2N with the space report number 274, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, we still have power. Looking at the winds, according to the computer, it looks like it's... We're getting probably 50-mile-an-hour winds, and now we drop down to around 47, 48. You're a little bit further away west of me. You're probably around 43 miles an hour. So, I think it's starting to drift further and further east. So it's like 22,637 people on Long Island at this time. We'll see what happens. I usually talk about an ISS pass when that's going to happen. Looks like Halloween morning, not night. Morning, there's going to be a nice pass. So if you're, you know, up early, going to work or something, and it's 6:12 in the morning, and if you look to the southwest, around 15 degrees above the horizon, let me drop it, you'll be able to pick up the ISS, and it's going to be pretty bright, negative 2.9, so any kind of a number like that is usually very, very bright. And it will go right overhead, so wherever you are on Long Island, you can look up. It'll be heading, like, right overhead. 80.7 degrees. And then it'll wind up in the southwest. And, you know, probably around 10, 15 degrees above the horizon. So it'll be roughly a 6 minute pass or so. So from 6:12 a.m., to 6:18 a.m. So that should be pretty good. There's six people on board. You could wave and tell them happy Halloween. That's the story on that. Let me drop it.
Yeah, you said it started at the southwest, and then you said it ends at the southwest. That seems a little bit strange. Run that by again, Eric. I mean, the pole.
No, okay, southwest to the northeast. That's where it's going to wind up. So it'll go right over your head, which is nice because a lot of people, like me, have trees all over, houses. And it's very hard to see when they don't go above, let's say, 15, 20 degrees. But this thing's going to be 80 degrees, so that should be very good. And last time I saw it was at night, and I know I can see the solar panels. Just make out really see that kind of brightness. That was a little brighter, around 3.1 or something. A little bit brighter than this. Minus 2.9 on the magnitude scale. So to give you an idea, I think the sun is minus 27. So that's really bright. Let me drop it.
And this is the morning of Halloween, and I think you said at 6:12 in the morning it comes up at southwest is when we see this. And I presume a person could check on the specifics.